For me, the Romani band today is, it's, I think every day I add something new to the Romani band because the work I do and because I help my people and I support my people because I believe that, I think that all of us who has a privilege in this world or Roma should give the others. It's not comfortable, believe me.
Romatopia. Roma tai sintura ceren svato katrlenđi utopia. Sarbi šaja e Evropa tharate avel.
So welcome and Lacho Divis to the next episode of the podcast Romatopia. Roma talk about their utopia for Europe. My name is Isabel Rabe and I'm hosting this podcast together with William Bila.
And a big welcome to everyone also from my side.
In this podcast, we are going to talk to Roma from all over Europe and beyond about their lives, about their experiences and about their utopia. We want to present counter-images and counter-narratives to oppose stereotypes and prejudices.
In the coming months, we will be talking to a number of noteworthy community members from a varied cross-section of the Romani peoples. I'm really interested in hearing about what being Romani is to other people because we don't get a chance to discuss this topic very much. For those who do not know, the Romani peoples are Europe's largest minority. This includes Sinti, Roma, Gitanos, Romanis, and other groups who loosely share a common ancestry and have been present in Europe for well over 600 years. Through linguistic theories, we know they originated in India, traveled through Persia, and were present in the Eastern Roman Empire for some time before dispersing throughout Europe. Their economic and cultural contributions have historically been overlooked. Their history is an integrally interwoven part of European history, which also is often mistaken as one of external exclusion and hardship. Though periods of extreme persecution did make their mark well before the 20th century and the genocide which we suffered during the Second World War. After the fall of the Iron Curtain in 1989, Romani peoples have gradually been making themselves more visible on the European scene.
We already talked to a number of interesting and thought-provoking people in this podcast, with activists, artists, curators. We had very inspiring conversations, but we have to offer more. So let's welcome our today's guest, Nicoletta Bitu. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi. Morning.
Good morning. Good morning to London. Today we are in Paris, in Berlin, and in London for this podcast. Nico, let's start with a little game. We asked someone who knows you to just describe you in one sentence. I'm going to read the sentence to you and you have to guess who said this, okay? We've only met once, but rarely I found it so easy to bond with someone. And her stuffed vine leaves that we prepared together are delicious.
Should be one of your kids.
Yes.
It's Aaron.
Yes.
Aaron.
Yes, I asked him. Aaron. You two just met once when you stayed in my place during one of the Rom Archive board meetings. Yes. And it was really funny because you two had an instant connection to each other. Yes. He was 19 at that time. And when he heard that you will be our next guest, he asked me if he could be the one to describe you in one sentence.
Oh, I love him. Thank you very much. It's really touchy because I was like, you know, what, expecting something, you know, from my colleagues. But, you know, it's been an instant connection with Aaron. And I remember he was a shy boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
But with me, he had a connection. Yeah. True.
Yeah. Absolutely. And another thing that was amazing is he really doesn't like cooking. He hates cooking, but for hours and hours, the two were sitting together preparing those stuffed vine leaves. That was really nice.
Yes, I remember. It was a really nice time. Yeah. Thank you very much. And tell him that I love him. Even
I will.
Though we met once. He's a very special human being. So.
Nico, could I ask you, could you describe yourself in one sentence?
I was thinking about this all day yesterday. You give me homeworks, guys. it's difficult to describe myself in one sentence, but I think for me, it's my mantra was everything I do it from my because I believe in. It's nothing about career advancement or PR or, I mean, being famous. Everything I do it because I believe in it. So I'm a kind of a believer. That's maybe, yeah. That's, I can't do something which I do not believe in. So.
Okay. Even though, I have a short CV about you I'd like to read, and you can let me know if there's anything incorrect or if it sounds good to you. Dr. Nicoleta Bitu graduated in social work from the University of Bucharest. She has been active in the field of human and women's rights for over 28 years, at the forefront of the European mobilization of Romani women activists and of advocacy for the rights of Roma. Her PhD thesis was about Romani women and feminism. The foundation of her training remains the work she performed in the early years of her career in local communities affected by inter-ethnic conflicts. A recognized expert in her field, she has worked for Romani Cris, Open Society Foundations, the Council of Europe, Romani Boutique, the European Institute for Arts and Culture, Rome Archive, Rome Education Fund, and many more. Her work has provoked the Romani and feminist movements to think and act based on the universality of human rights when it comes to Romani women. Is there anything missing?
Quite impressive, no?
Yes, it is very impressive.
It is.
When I hear it from someone else, No, I think what is missing is the fact that I have contributed to the formation of many generations of Romani activists, not only women, but one of my continuous and permanent job since I came, even though I was young, is to really inspire and contribute to the growth, personal growth of other people around me. So that's been one of continuous line of my, like a red line.
Absolutely. So, and I want to say I'm one of those people that you influenced. You taught me as well. And I appreciate it very much. I think you're the first person who taught me that feminism isn't just for women. Feminism is for men and women. And you explained very clearly that if something is feminist, it doesn't mean that it's against men, because it's for women and for men both. It's for a better world. So thank you very much.
Yeah, welcome. Thank
great.
You.
Yeah. It starts already very amazing, this conversation. Let's go back in time, Nico, so that our listeners get to know you even a little better. Let's talk about your childhood and your family. What is your most vivid memory of your childhood?
Oh, unfortunately, it's not a happy one. It's been an incident which followed me all my life. And in fact, it's the incident which made me, you know, it's not sad, but it's an incident which made me what I am today. And I was 4 years old. We moved in a new blocks of flats with my family in a kind of a new neighborhood in Constanța, which is on the Black Sea coast. And it was a majority Romanian neighborhood. My father was a police officer in that time. So we moved in that blocks of flats. I was outside with some kids playing, and we were playing quite well. And when they got bored of me, they started to call me Gypsy, like Tiganga, you know, in Romanian. Mm-hmm. So I started to cry because I didn't understand what is going on, what is wrong. And I went to my mom, and she said, I mean, I'm blessed that I was born in that family, in a way. From some perspectives, not all. But my mom said, there's nothing wrong in being Roma. They are wrong because they have, you know, bad souls. And it's nothing, you have to be proud that you are Roma, because Roma are, you know, we are good people, and you have to be proud to be that. So in a way, this, that incident shaped me for the whole rest of my life. And I'm thankful to my mother and my father that I grew up with dignity in being Roma, not a shame in being Roma. So I think I will thank them until I die for that, because many, many Roma in that time, in communist time, it was communist time in Romania, 75, I think it was in 75 when it happened. In 75, many Roma started to be integrated and, you know, jobs, because it was a communist state, and education and everything. And it was an increased tendency among Roma medium class to hide their identity, because it's not comfortable to be Roma. Not that today is more comfortable.
No, but that's very important. You said, you know, your parents gave you, or your mom gave you that feeling of dignity, and you have nothing to be ashamed of. But a lot of people don't know that. They don't say that to their kids, or they it's easier for them to hide it, to not deal with this, because they don't know how to answer that question. It's still absolutely true for a lot of people.
Yeah. Even today, and in fact, it's both of my parents, because my father's mother tongue was Romanes. He passed away. So, but he jumped from a very poor Kaldarash family, with a large family, and he ended up being a police officer. But a police officer who didn't hide his identity. He was always being proud of his Roma identity. His nickname was Bitsu Tsiganu. It's like the Bitsu Gypsy, the Gypsy Bitsu. So, and he was a very, very good professional criminalist. You know, he was really respected by the colleagues, but he didn't escape discrimination as well. So in this respect, I grew up in a family for whom the Romani identity was something which was like public statement almost.
I see. Yeah, you once said that in one of the interviews I read, if you deny your family, then you deny yourself. One of my questions would be, how do you live or experience these family ties? But you already answered it was really like being aware of the Roma identity that tied you as a family also.
How to say that? I grew up this tied with my family, and the fact that our Roma identity was like a public statement. Mm-hmm. It's like I grew up, my aunts, the sisters of my father, they used to wear these traditional clothes, right? Uh-huh. So they came in this fancy neighborhood in Constanza. And for me, keeping the ties with my family was like, this is who I am. And I have to say that my mom was quite tough with us on this respect. She was like, it's your fault, aunt, you don't have to be ashamed of this, the kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, it was normal to walk on the streets with my aunts traditionally dressed. I mean, I didn't feel anything like, you know, or shame or proud. It's like I felt it's normal. So I think for me, it was to better understand who I am, I have to understand my family and my ties and my roots. And as older as I become, I discover I belong to my family so much, so much. Even though sometimes my cousins and my sister and my brother, they are joking that I am a genetic accident.
Oh, really? Wow. Tough joke.
Oh, I tell you why, because you know, all women in my family is from my mom and my brother and my father's side. They are very tremendous cookers. You know, these women who like to cook, you know, their houses are like, you know,
traditional way.
No, not traditional way, but you know, the mirror status or their social status or their, I don't know if it's not only social status, it's their vision for life. And I'm like, you know, I'm the one who never speaks about that. or do these things. Sometimes we joke one with the other and they say, you're a genetic accident. You're a woman who is not part of this family for sure. I don't know what I'm going to do.
What was it like in school for you?
Oh, God. school was. So, as I told you, our Romani identity was not, it was a public statement. So everybody knew that we are Roma because mm-hmm. my father was quite well known in the town. So in school, I mean, the fact that I grew in that family was also a blessing, but it's also a curse because all my life I had to prove that Roma are different than the others are thinking that they are. So in the sense, all my childhood was marked by the fact that I was a little bit, I felt the pressure to prove that I am the best one. All my childhood and all my school was marked by that. I had to prove all the time to the others that Roma could be different than they think that Roma are. It was a mixture of good things and bad things, my school years. I was really loved by some teachers. I think most of the teachers loved me because I was a good kid and a smart one, but some of them not. I entered in fights. You can imagine, you cannot imagine this about me now. Peaceful Nico, anti-violent. I was quite mm-hmm. the fighter when I was a child.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I entered once in a fight with two boys. And I remember once I entered in a very physical fight with three neighbors in our flat, in our blocks of flat, because they called names to my sister. I was defending my sister. And I entered in a physical. So it's like, it's interesting because... I forgot about this.
Yeah, and also you said, you once said, we Roma are no fighters. We are not good in this. We are survivors, but no fighters.
Fighters in the sense, I meant fighters in the sense that, you know, organized fights, no.
Yeah.
Like, we are fighters, we are survivors, but I meant fighters in an organized way.
Yeah.
Later at university, how was it? Was it still the same kind of atmosphere? You've had to prove yourself and some professors were more openly discriminatory than others or
No, I mean, at university, it was so different because when I started social work in university, I was already working. I was already an activist. So I was working in 91. I have started to work in a 20 kilometers away from Constanza in Mihail Cogălnicianu, where houses of Roma were burned. So that's the time when I met Nicolae Gheorghe. I was already working as an activist. So when I entered the university, it was like, basically was kind of a theorizing, learning theories about what I was already doing. So the university was really different. I don't remember in university to have some instances like that. I had some I had some really funny story because one of my teachers, my professors, it was also a police officer and a high rank police officer who was teaching law in our university. And before he became, I mean, before I met him as a teacher, I met him in a seminar. And it was a discussion about the name Roma and Gypsy, you know, because Romania has been always this discussion about Roma and Romanians and the confusion about Roma and Romania. And that was, again, this discussion about how Roma are destroying the image of Romania outside and that everybody confused Roma with Romania. Anyway, they wanted to name in Tsiga. So we had a fight during the seminar. And then when I have seen him in the classroom, I was like freezing. And he started to teach. I was okay. I mean, but then we had a kind of a class. And one of the colleagues said something about, he had the questions about Tiga, you know. And my teacher was like, oh, be careful how you talk. Tomorrow you can be in the newspapers.
Oh, that's good. That's
great.
Good.
You convinced him.
You have a colleague here who is watching us.
Very good.
It was really funny. Yeah.
Nico, you mentioned Nicolae Gheorghe. You've been married. He's one of the most important Roma civil rights activists, passed away in 2013. how does a marriage work between two people whose activism is such a fundamental part of their lives? Because you also once said that the work, and in the beginning you emphasized this, your work as an activist is not just a job, it's your life. Are there political and intellectual debates going on all the time, 24 hours a day, between you as a couple? How was it?
First, I have to say that I think I was blessed to have, in this life, to have had such a, to have met such love. It was not easy. It was kind of, I'm really emotional now because this year was like 7 years since he died. And I think we miss him more than ever. It was really funny because Nikolai in the private life was a wonderful father, first of all, to all the others. If you could see him in the meetings and then with his daughters, with our daughters, it was really another person. And yes, we had debates, intellectual debates. And in my last interview, I think I've said that part of my Romanistan and all the debates we had, it's part of the debates I have had with him. But it was, in a way, how to say, not all the time debates or intellectual debates, but I mean, we build a lot around us. I have this feeling of not living a life for nothing, you know, both of us. What I'm really sorry is that he didn't have time to write because he was running from a place to another. And that's one of the lessons I've learned from him is that I need to concentrate more on things I need to do and I believe in them than to let myself thrown in different directions and lose myself in a way. But he was a brilliant mind. He had a brilliant mind. I think he was a genius. He predicted things. I mean, as a husband, was not very comfortable sometimes because he was like perceiving me as I was not a different person. We were kind of a whole, an inseparable whole. Like, you know, these two halves which come together and it's like you have one whole. And he perceived it us as like one whole. And if I wanted to do something different, then it was a problem. It was really, how to say, yeah, it was a whole. And he perceived me like sometimes a continuation of himself. And then these are the instances when I reacted because I wanted to always be a person. And I succeeded to be different than him. That's one of the things I am proud of is that people tended to copy him, you know, because he was a role model. But I have succeeded to remain myself. He influenced my thinking a lot, of course. But in a way, our beliefs, we were the people who believed in what we did. We were the believers, yeah.
Yeah. I think you said once that he was questioning your feminism, saying that with this Romani women movement, you're splitting the Romani movement. I found this very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if this was a singular opinion or did you hear this accusation from many sides, like splitting the movement?
Oh, yeah. He didn't say that. I was splitting the movement. Other Romani men colleagues. He questioned my feminism because he supported my feminism in the beginning very much. I don't know if I said this ever, but I was in a privileged position in conversation with other Romani activists when I started my feminism, proving my dedication for the cause because it was 97, 98, something like that, 99. And I was already proving my dedication for the Roma cause. Secondly, it was because I was married to Nikolai. The third privilege came from the fact that I was married and had two kids already. So I, like, from the social point of view of women roles, I was like ticking all of the boxes. That's why, in a way, and his support in the beginning, because he was a feminist as well. The questioning and the debate become to be in our, when we had problems in our couple, you know. And of course, it's sometimes easier to blame an ideology than to to really analyze the behavior of the partners, both of us. And when he got sick, we came back from Warsaw, he got sick with cancer. He was not very well received in Romania, like he didn't find his place back in Romania. It was quite a very dark period for him especially. He was depressed. He had a severe depression, I think. I was finding my way. I went back to work with colleagues in Romania and Greece. So in a way, all his frustrations, and I think the disease was also already installed in his body, cancer. So in that period, he started to question my family. And in the beginning, I was upset, but then I started to debate with him. And that was, I think, the most amazing thing about Nicolae was he had this, you know, intellectual discipline of debating. He was not getting upset with you. I mean, with me he was, but with others not. But I've learned from him to debate and to listen to, you know, others. Then I said, okay, let's talk about that. Let's do something about that. I mean, not fighting, but, you know, let's do something like that for that. But he was blaming the feminists for some of my attitude, something like that. And I have tried to explain that it's nothing to do with my feminism. It's because of his behavior. But, you know, you know, it was really, it's the first time when I said that to someone in an interview, but I think it's time to say that. It was not easy. I mean, 4 years of treatment and everything was really difficult for the whole family. And in the same time, his son from the previous marriage died during these 4 years. So we had quite a rough time. And then in the last year of his life, I don't know how it came to me. I said, okay, I don't know how long he will survive, will be alive. Then I told to myself, I will change my attitude and I will take everything what comes from him and create space for him to do something. You know? So together with Ciprian, Necula, and with Florina Asture and other colleagues, we have started, and with colleagues and I was in a PhD program in that time. We started to cultivate relation with him. It was Adrian Schiop, Elena Radu, and Andrea Braga, and Ciprian Tudor. So we were kind of a small group of PhD students in that time, all activists, most of us, not Roma. There were no Roma too in that group. We started to cultivate relationship with him and debate with him. That's how we started the idea of a new Romani pen, you know, and how a Romani pen will look from a feminist perspective, or how a new modern Romani pen should be reinvented from a political perspective, not only from a traditional cultural or different. In a way, I'm really happy that I took the decision to humbly receive everything what comes from him, because 1 year later he died. He died at home with us. It's good, yeah.
Good. So the daughter, the whole family was with him then.
Yeah,
that's good. Yeah, it's still a kind of commemoration day, the day he died. Each year, the whole Roma community is commemorating.
I don't think it's as much as he should deserve. It's 8th of August or 12th of November is his birthday, because sometimes we said it's better to... Immediately after he died, I had this impression that everybody's waiting something from me. And it's interesting because we had a discussion before he died about that I don't have to prove anything to anyone, he told me. So no longer. He asked me to don't try to prove anything to anyone any longer, because I have, all my life was a kind of demonstration. I had his blessing not to.
No, that's interesting. No, I mean, it's very relevant for the specific situation, but it's interesting that you say that, because this is a theme that comes up from our other guests as well, in various ways, that you know, whether it's because of their experience or their age or their specific situation in life. But we've talked to different Roma people on our podcast, and they also expressed this, you know, I don't need to prove anything to anybody. I certainly feel the same way in terms of you get to a certain point and you work hard, you want to achieve something, but in your personal life and regarding what you've experienced, there's something that remains private or there's something that remains unspoken, but that's nobody's business, or you don't have to show some kind of accomplishment or demonstrate something because that's life and you have the right to have a good life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's something which was like for us activists, we lived our lives under the pressure all the time, under the pressure to defend our people, under the pressure to educate others and to really fight with the systems and everything. So in a way, he took the pressure off my shoulders during that discussion in personal life. So I mean, I cannot separate really my personal life from the movement, but anyway, yeah. it's been a struggle for me to do that. But anyway, he in a way gave me the blessing before he died that I don't have to do in personal life nothing to demonstrate something to others. He asked me to be myself. It's interesting because one of my our common friend who is very old since 92 from North Romania, she was very close to both of us, and she called me last year and she told me that she dreamed of him, and telling her to tell me to start writing. So it was really funny. Anyway, dream, yeah. Funny, anyway.
Let's make a little jump. Mm-hmm. You're in the UK now, right? And you travel a lot, and your children studied abroad, and also in your job as an activist, you're here and there all over Europe. Where do you really feel at home?
That's a very difficult question, because even here, being with all my family, I don't feel at home. Mm-hmm. So I feel at home wherever I am with my kids, but it's because my kids are young adults, 25 years old. Mm-hmm. I have to really find my home in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the last, let's say, 2 years, I think I felt home in the arms of my current partner. He's away. He's a sailor. Mm-hmm.
So he's traveling a lot as well.
Oh,
as a sailor.
But I don't know. I think I feel, you know, when I feel at home, I feel at home when I have this. For me, home is nothing physical. For me, home is when I have the feeling of fulfillment. And it's interesting because I have not run away, but I left 1 year ago from Romania and from taking a break from the Roma elites mobilization because I couldn't find myself. So metaphorically taking a break. And I wanted to do something so differently. And I ended up applying for a job for I worked in a warehouse for 2 months, like all immigrants who are coming here. So it was a very, very interesting experience, and I really valued immensely. You know me, I was modest all my life. I didn't cry about the things I have done. But that experience gave me, you know, understand what means, what humble means, you know, and how life can change from a day to another. You are today the famous Nico, and you can be tomorrow the nobody. I realized that I can be nobody any minute.
I experienced you, or I got to know you that way as well. Already a couple of years ago, it started that you were thinking about taking a break, and you did. You withdraw from a lot of positions in boards, etc. And I also remember that once you were thinking about opening a Romani restaurant in Berlin. Now you're working in a warehouse in London. So yes, you can be anyone, anytime. I got the impression.
Nico, were you in the UK for the first lockdown or the beginning of the pandemic?
No, I mean, and then I applied for a job to St. Mungo's, and it's a foundation, the biggest foundation in the UK, which works with the homeless people. So I said, okay, I mean, all my life I've done this helping others. And it's like I remain faithful to myself. So I go and work with homeless. So when they recruited me, they said, oh, God, you are amazing and everything. And I said, okay. I passed through the test, of course. And then they assigned me to the Westminster outreach team. And guess what? 120 Roma rough sleeping in the center of London.
Oh, really?
I was like, what?
Again?
What is going on? And it's interesting because my daughters are like, they said, okay, you are in a warehouse. What kind of exercise is this, mom? Tell us. Do you think you can escape your whole life?
Like, you know, no, you can't.
Like... So in a way, coming here in UK, and I've worked all the pandemic with people on the streets and daily contact with Roma, it makes me understand our people, because I think I was so far away from the reality of our people. And I think we are sometimes very far away from the reality of our people living and our people mental universe. And being here and working with them, I understand the limitations of the mental universe. What are the priorities of our people? So in a way, this whole experience of going away, I was very proud of me that I was like 50 years old. I took everything from zero. I gave up all my social status back home in Romania. While I was invited to go in politics or to have public, to go in government. So I was very proud of myself that when I was 50, I stuck with my decision to take a break. In the essence, it's like to understand who I am.
Well, this pandemic probably has contributed to that, but how? How has the pandemic maybe affected your thinking and do you think it's helped the fact that you've had more time to think about some of these more personal issues? Or I think people would like to know, how has the pandemic affected you?
Huh. I didn't have time to reflect because I was working all the time. I was on the streets. I think it affected, on personal level, it affected my relationship with my partner immensely. But there's another discussion, but it affected with my current partner. So in a professional or in a very personal way, I think the whole pandemic for me, it's really related, for example, with this. It remembered me of my childhood readings of, because I used to read when I was like 11, 12, 13, like teenager, these science fiction books, which is in 80s, you know, science fiction books.
Yeah.
And in a way, I felt in that now when COVID came, that I live in that science fiction literature I used to read. It's also, it made me more conscious and more alert than usual. The pandemic made me more alert to the politics. And I have seen how pandemics was used by politics and people of power. And I was all the time afraid that of this dictatorship coming into place in different forms, with democratic votes in place, but confirming the dictatorship, or this whole craziness with Trump in US and with Kia, with Boris Johnson, the connection between the two, the UK and US, and the Brexit. And it was really kind of, for me, a rearranging of the whole world, the way we know it. So the pandemic was, for me, was more a time to reflect on how the world is changing and how dangerous, how the danger is across the corner. Of our liberties and our freedoms and of our political systems as we know it. I was really, really worried and had discussions with my family about that. And they said, I'm crazy in the beginning. And after a couple of months, they came to me and said, like, you're right. Look what they do. But in the same time, for the rough sleepers was an opportunity, because the local authorities put them inside.
Yeah.
So in a way, in the whole craziness of this crisis, another utopia came to life. as to have everybody inside from the streets, you know, as an utopia we work for. So it was really interesting to see these two sides of the pandemic. And also, yeah, it's for me, it's self-discovered that I still have the power of resilience. I didn't know that I still have this power in me. Because it was a comfortable activism. I was in conferences, in, you know, doing good things, of course. I will never say that I've done bad things or that it was not important what I have done. It's far from me to say that everything I've done in the last 10 years with Roma Museum and the European Roma Institute for Arts and Culture, and my influence in everything is important. I do not want to annulate the importance of these things. But in the same time, like, you know, being here with people close, it made me realize that I haven't lost this sense of resilience, which I had it in the beginning when I started to be an activist. Sometimes I got sick, you know, Isabel knows better that.
Yes, I remember.
My body, because of the autoimmune disease I have, my body sometimes has claims its right to rest. You know, it's like, I discover myself in a way, in different ways, and I came to peace with myself.
Yeah, it's really interesting, like, that the pandemic is also for all of us kind of warning that things have to change in many ways, and maybe it could be a starting point for those changes. Nico, let's have a short break. We asked you to bring us a guest gift. We love gifts, Bill and me. So we asked you to bring us something, an object or whatever, an item that is important for you. And we are very curious what you brought us and why.
There's a picture of my daughters.
Smiling,
two of them. Mm-hmm.
The very beautiful daughters, to add.
So it's like a picture for a couple of years ago. And they are both smiling. And the position they have, they are in posing, is a position which reproducing a position from their when they were babies, you know, babies. So the fact I like about this picture is that they smile and they have a light on their eyes and the smiling, and they are beautiful women. Oh my God.
Yes, they are.
I'm not their mother.
Come on.
You know why I brought this picture, this gift to you, is because my daughters have been my compass for my life. Since I have them, they have been my compass. And they've been, how to say, in some days when I was down, they've been the reason why I woke up and starting the day all over again. And still the reason why in some days I wake up and, okay, start over again. So they've been my reason to be. And they saved me from many things. I mean, they saved me from darkness many, many, many times. So, because I have a darkness in myself. Of course, as all of us. And sometimes I go deeper in this darkness. But these two souls have saved me, my soul, all the time. And I think my activism also is because I want them to live in a better society.
No problem. Thank you for this nice gift. We put it on our virtual gift shelf.
Yes, thank you.
With all the other nice gifts we already received, didn't we, Bill?
Yes, yes, exactly. But getting back to work, we want to talk about your work. I think we have to talk about feminism. I'd like to ask you, when did you know or when did you decide to become a feminist?
Oh, Bill, I think all my life I was a feminist. But I didn't know that it's called like that. Yeah, when I was a teenager, I was a child. Oh, God. Do I have to say that or not?
It's up to you. But I think you just did answer it. If that's good enough for you, it's good. It has to be good enough for everybody else.
Okay. I was defending my mom all the time since I was a child, and my aunts, because they've been subjected to domestic violence. I was a spoiled child of the large family. All large family have spoiled me and loved me because I was smart. I had this, you know, this privilege and the guts to fight with my uncles and everybody around because they had mistreated their wives, my mom. I was fighting with my father all my life. I had to fight with my mother. That's where I think the feminism started. My feminism started. And when I was working in conflicts in the 90s, I have worked a lot with Romani women and I have seen during the conflicts, you know, the communities rearranging and this disclosing every layers of its structures. The 1993, I wrote my first essay about during the post-conflict situations, you know. And I didn't know that it's autodidact feminist. And in 97, I think, 97, yes, I was invited to the, it was Roma Participation Program of the Open Society Institute, Rio now. And it was a conference of Romani women. It was Rulko Kavchinski, the head of RPP then, and he organized the women's conference. And then I have met then, Asbia Memendova, and I remember I met my soul sister, Sister Deborah Schultz, an American Jewish historic feminist. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, during the conference, questioning things, and I have brought a book with me from Leto Tigan. It was dedicated to Romani women, and I know that there was a hearing in the Council of Europe in 95, 96, and we have sent from Romania two or three Romani women. So I was kind of, but my feminism have started to grow when I met Deborah, and then I was invited to New York as a consultant of the Open Society Institute Network Women Program to start strategizing together with Liliana Kovacheva from Bulgaria, to start strategizing and thinking about the Romani Women Program under the Network Women Program. So that was, I remember Deborah going online on Amazon, ordered books for me. So if I owe to someone the knowledge about feminism, it gave me the first books of feminism. She gifted to me the Bell Hooks book, Anti-Woman. So when I came back, I remember it was, then we moved to Warsaw, and then on Italy holiday, me and Nikolai were sharing that book. Yeah, we shared that book because it was the book which gave me a new perspective on the things I've done. So that's how I became a feminist. In a way, unfortunately enough, it's in the current writings about Romani feminists, because I didn't have time to write and I mostly acted. My contribution is so much highlighted.
I have a question, because you mentioned the feminist literature you were reading. We have this debate that feminism ignores, that the white feminism, let's say, ignores the needs of black women, of POC women, of Romani women. What is your opinion about this?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, it's like it was when I started in 97, 98, it was this complete ignorance. And I mean, for me, I remember, I have to tell you this story. In 99, I was in Budapest. The Network Women program have invited me to participate to their network. It was a network of gender programs in all Europe, in Central and Eastern Europe. So they said, okay, Nico, you come and we discuss about Romani women. I said, okay. I went to Budapest to the meeting. And in a way, I didn't expect it. I expected to be in a friendly environment, you know. I'm women's rights activist. Wow. And it's, you know, I go to my two colleagues, you know, from human rights activism with humanistic perspective on things, you know. And during the meeting and my expose, I was like, I had such a racist attitude from that gender coordinator, some of them, not all of them, of course, and that I got sick during the night. So all the energy I have received. And then was the moment of alignment. That not automatically all other human rights activists working for other really they start to love Roma. So they have other different positive opinion. So it's like really, that was an enlightenment moment for me when I understood part of my job is to really try to connect the two worlds and make the white feminism aware that the Roma women have their needs and that they struggle inside with these combined identities and with essentialism from women's side, essentialism from Roma side. So it was like all these debates about essentializing our identities. Either you are woman first, either you are Roma first. And my Roma colleagues have started to question it's like what you are first, Roma. You are true Roma in some articles in early 1999, 2000. So it was this entire debate about essentialism.
Did it change now as we all talk about intersectionality and we start thinking all these fights together? Did you experience that it changed?
I think it changed a lot, but not enough. Not enough. But yes. It's changed. I mean, it's really changed. And when I look around, it's really changed. And the feminist and Romani movement became more aware of that. So, I mean, to live a life where you witness that is really, again, a blessing. Because, you know, starting this debate in 99 and be alive and be still present of this society, Roma society.
Yeah.
And to see this is really a blessing.
Yeah, I think so too. Because I wasn't so involved in the 90s, but I also had this feeling like this whole aspect is missing. And it actually kept me from getting involved to a certain extent. And I seeing the change that there are enough people that have enough awareness about this to actually, help bring about some implement and institute some of these, some of this awareness. I think, it's not enough, but it's certainly a lot more than 20 years ago.
And it's like LGBTQ eyes. I was among the first ones to defend my LGBTQ colleagues from others. I had fights with people because of some of my colleagues. So for me, I think the drive was always the humanism in us. And if another Roma is questioning another Roma, then you reproduce the same thing which the Gaja are doing with us. So it's nothing different. It's the same mechanism which is in place. So for me, it was like, I will never like another person to be treated as I was treated when I was a child or growing up. So why? Why?
That's beautifully said. And I think everyone needs to hear that. That's we need to hear that every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Nico, let's jump to another topic, to arts and culture. You once said you can't fight racism without addressing arts and culture. Can you explain to our listeners what you mean by this and why?
It's because I realized after, it's like in September, 29 years of activism with only 3 months of where I'm breastfeeding my kids. So I realized that all the talking with doers and activists and all the fightings and, you know, I don't deny they're important. They are very important. It doesn't touch the minds and souls of other people as art does, you know. It's important what we do, the politicians of the cause. That's what I consider myself, a politician of the cause, even though I don't have a mandate from anyone. For me, I realized how the expression of emotions and in arts touch the minds of other people more than any words I have done or debates I have put on. That's why, and it's also because doing the Roma Hive exercise in early, very early when we started the Roma Hive and started to look to the movement from this arts perspective, and also being in the Roma Museum in Bucharest together with my colleagues in Romano Boutique at that time, and researching for the history and everything, I discovered that that's a huge legacy. Views, there's a poetry, music, and this kind of stuff. So, being only civil rights civil rights activists, we ignored that. So, for me, arts and culture is very important because that is the sorts of people more than I could ever do. I think.
Yeah, and it's both. It's both a tool of resistance and a way to show the richness and to create a positive image of the Roma and to show their contribution to cultural history.
And I'm really jealous on our artists, and I told them sometimes because I'm jealous because you can express your emotions and pain and pride and all the spectrum of emotions in being Roma. What? Which is like a complete kind of a therapy, if you ask me. But anyway, I'm really jealous of and I admire our artists, all of them. Doesn't matter what they do. Admire them. But the way they put forward emotions and their Roma identity.
Yeah,
I think you expressed that beautifully because, well, if you also look at politics and any activist movement today, emotions are valid data points. You have to address emotions. People have fear. Whether or not that fear is justified, the fear exists. It is there. And I think if you don't have arts and culture to address fear or to express other emotions, I think, what you said is very important there. I'm going to change the subject again, moving on to the next question, bouncing around a bit. This podcast, we aim to highlight the diversity of Roma and their different national characteristics and heterogeneous culture. What is being Romani for you, or what is Romani Pen for you? Romani Pe or Romani Pen, roughly translated as Romani-ness or Romani-hood, it is a noun created from the adjective Romani, which describes things coming from Roma peoples. The suffix ipe is added to an adjective to create an abstract noun. Another example, sasto is healthy, sastipen is health. Romani Pen can be quite a complex concept with many details, which can describe behavior in certain situations, ranging from cleanliness rituals and preparing food, or simply conformity to group norms within a given community. Someone with Romani Pe does not deny their heritage. Programs which focus on improving the positive self-image of Roma focus on building an awareness of Romani Pe as a positive source of value for personal identity and belonging to the group or the groups of Romani peoples. It can also be referred to as what ties Roma together across distinct Romani communities as well, especially in the last 30 years. Often today, depending on the context, it can simply mean proud to be Roma. What is Romani Pen for you?
Oh, God. How much time do we have left?
Take your time.
Okay, let me drink some coffee, you know.
So that's the hardest one?
Yeah, big, heavy question. No. That's a good answer. I like that. It is. I just kind of like threw that at you, and it's like it is all of a sudden a big change. But you mentioned a little bit about it earlier. You talked about, you know, you had some ideas and there are all these things that could enter into it. And yeah, maybe it's changed for you over time, or you don't have a fixed definition. Maybe you
I mean, for me, Romani Pen came in my life while I was an activist. In my family, Romani Pen was not part of our vocabulary. Was my Romani identity was everyday play, as I told you. And it gave me, for example, the fact that when to my father's family, I learned Romanes when I was a child. And all my summers, we went there, and it was a connection with people, which gave me the connection with my large family was part of my identity. Being Roma was these connections, these ties I had with my large family. Also, for me, being Roma was, in that time, the racism of the others was embodied. I cannot deny the fact that being Roma is not only about, for me, was not only the ties with my large family and my cousins and my aunts and these two different, because I belong to two different groups of Roma, like Kodorash family and musician family. And one was richer, social status better than the other. So it's like I had to somehow be part of a universe where the Romani identity has been played in different ways. For me, the racism was part of my identity as well. I mean, I was shaped by the racism of the others. But I also was shaped by the language. I was shaped by the stories of my aunts, by the attitudes of my family towards the others. And also the stories of my grandfather from my mother's side, because he used to tell us stories about his travels when he was a musician and about the aristocracy and all these stories about being Roma in his youth. So in a way, that was how I grew up. But when I became an activist, Romani Pen became a debate when we started to discuss about European Roma and Travelers Forum. So it was this kind of power relationship of us. I was part of the group, but not so active. It was Rusko Kapczynski, Nikolai. It was Miranda Wallastrana from Finland. Uh-huh. It was Soraya Post. It was Andre in the beginning. Andre and Nikolai, they were in the beginning, but then they were not so much involved. It was Ashmet Elezovsky from Macedonia. So many, many people were involved in the time. And I was really, again, privileged to have witnessed these debates among them, because I grew up with these debates among these kind of big figures in the Roma movement, Nikolai, Andrei, and Rusko. So for me, Romani Pen became a political subject in the time when the European Roma Entrepreneurs Forum started. And in time, I positioned myself in opposition to the European Travelers Forum, because in the European, the Charter of Romani Rights of the European Roma and Travelers Forum said there's something about Roma identity. The Roma are the ones who respect Romani Pen. So then the discussion with Nicolae started of what is Romani Pen for us, uh-huh, and how we reconstruct Romani Pen. So for me, my feminism gave me the perspective of power on everything I have seen around me. And I said, who the hell we are to define what is Romani Pen first? Then I said, okay, to myself, all nations have been constructed by intellectuals and political people, and they defined who the Romanians are and what Romania means or what Germany means, you know? So I said, okay, we are no different than the others, so it's normal. Then my feminism also said, but if we want to be respected equal, then we have to respect our people inside. And it all already came through the stories I told you about fighting about my women colleagues, or fighting about LGBT colleagues, and also fighting with some Roma men who beat their wives at home. So where is the question, how can you be a Roma rights activist when you beat your wife at home? I don't trust what you say in public. I don't trust what you say in public, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I cannot trust you that you want the good things for our people when you don't respect your wife at home. So all the discussion was, what thing has to do with another? And I said, a lot. Because it's about you and the coherence of your beliefs and your beliefs. So anyway, the whole Romani Pen question started to be a permanent question and preoccupation of ours, especially before Nicolae died. So for me now, Romani Pen, and it's also arts and culture, I realized, because with my feminism and during the tough debates with Nicolae, and the accusations from others in the Roma movement, I have said, okay, maybe they're right. What do I do with my Romani feminism? I destroy some of the practices. Yeah, right. What do I put in place? So I started to construct it. I said, I deconstruct this, right? What do I construct it? What do I put in place? I said, I have my responsibility as a Romani feminist who questions these, you know, practices and wants to delete these practices, if it's possible, to put something else in place. So that's where I started to become involved in this whole arts history and commemoration. So for me, it was like from the intellectual debate I had with Nicolae, to put in practice a little bit a reconstruction of the Romani pen, which is like more modern Romani pen, which is based on the creation, the power of creation of these people. We have an immense drive for creation. I mean, it's like, I cannot believe. I mean, it's like we have created so much, and every day we create even these kind of strategies to survive and to go from the most remote village in Romania to come in center of London. It's like, you know, no boundaries of the imagination.
I like hearing that. And I think it's very important as well, because what feminism brings, what the idea of creating and not necessarily reconstruction, but adding and creating to this idea, with keeping in mind what you said of not recreating the destructive tendency that's imposed from others outside onto us, that we don't recreate that inside. I think if we don't do that, it's a kind of Bibachtalo circle, basically.
Oh, yeah. And
what you're doing is you're making Romani Pem more Romani, basically. look from within to create something new, as opposed to accept what's coming from outside. I mean, like nationalism, you know, you look at nationalist movements, you know, the Austria-Hungarian Empire, and then the Czechs became independent. But what did the Czechs do to the Slovaks? And then the Slovaks, what did they do to the Roma? And everything is reproduced. And we have to stop this. And I think that this is an excellent example of how we stop this.
Yeah, it's because, you know, it's this circle of, it's like in a psychotherapy, you know, the psychotherapy of trauma. It's like you have to break the circle of the vicious circle of the legacy you have through the maternal side, right? So from my point of view, that's for us as a Roma nation, we have to break the circle. And I will not want to reproduce that's why for me, feminism and all the debate I had with Nicolae and all this, reflection, and you know, both of you, that I'm very self-reflection and everything. I reflect on everything I do. I don't speak a lot about it, and it's pity, I think, that I don't write a lot of pity, and that's, again, pity. Because for me, the construction of Roma nation should not reproduce what others made us to be today. It should be a society which is beyond of this, you know, inherited trauma, and beyond of what the societies have taught us, you know. For me, the Romani pen today is, I think every day I add something to the Romani pen, because the work I do, and because I help my people and I support my people, because I believe that, I think that all of us who has a privilege in this world, or Roma, should give the others. It's not comfortable, believe me, it's not. And all my life I had instances when I have been offended and aggressed and everything, but doesn't matter. It's like my whole life is the responsibility to serve my nation, to serve my people. And I to serve my people, because I think part of the Romani people should be this responsibility of the elites, because if the elites don't do anything and we are stuck in our closed society and we don't go out to our people, then it's no Romani pen, it's no nation there. For me, building a nation is everyday effort. I do it from a deep belief. It's like a service for my people. And because I consider myself, as I told you, one of the elites of this people, of this nation, and as an elite, I have the responsibility to serve my people, like a civil servant in a government, right? So I know that in my interview I said that I would like to be the president, but anyway.
I remember. I'm going to ask this later. No, but I think it's very good and very important that you say that this responsibility you're talking about, that the Roma elite of academics and activists do take, and you once called it, it's your duty to build a safety net for the community. So it's not only about fighting, but also about protecting, and that's really what you are doing. That's really impressive and important. Before we talk about Romanistan, and we certainly will, because this podcast is about the utopia, the Roma-topia, let's play another game. We are going to read you some terms, and you have to answer spontaneously, so without thinking, just with one word or a very short sentence, okay? Are you prepared? Are you ready? Good. So, women.
Power.
Community.
Solidarity.
Resistance.
Power.
Nature.
Peace.
Gender.
Bullshit. I'm sorry, guys.
No, that's good. That's good.
It's a social construct. Well, that's...
Mm-hmm. Home.
Peace.
Yesterday.
Great.
Tomorrow.
Hope.
Well, the next word for me is hope.
Hope. Dream.
Okay. Europe.
Bullshit.
Politics.
These are boundaries. I don't like it. I mean, it's like, I don't like boundaries.
Okay.
I'm sorry, guys.
No, that's good. That's good. Next word from me, Dilino.
Fun.
Okay, Bachtalo.
Bachtalo. I don't know. Best?
Okay. Gajo.
I don't like this. I don't like this word. I never liked it.
Okay. Anti-gypsyism.
Hate.
Great. Thank you. That's the end of our little game. Dilno is the Anglo-Romani word for fool or foolish. Dilino is the Central European version of the same word. It's the diminutive of the word dilo. This is originally an adjective, but can be used as a noun. And in both cases, even people who don't know Romani very well will often know this word. Buc is the Anglo-Romani word for luck. Its Central European version, bacht, means luck or happiness. Bachtalo is the adjective, means happy or lucky. It's typically used in a greeting, Teoves Bachtalo, may you be happy and lucky. Gorgio is the Anglo-Romani word for a non-Romani person. In Central European Romani, the word is gajo. In its original sense, it's not pejorative. Depending on context and tone of voice, it can be pejorative, and people not familiar with the Romani language often presume this negative meaning.
Let's talk about Romanistan. We already talked about it a bit. Let's talk about the utopia. Let's dream of Romanistan. Romanistan is the name of a proposed country for the Romani people. In the early 1950s, Roma leaders petitioned at the United Nations for the creation of their own state, but their petition was rejected. The creation of such a state was also suggested by the leaders of a Macedonian party in the early 1990s, with the aim of the complete emancipation of Romani people. Romanistan remains an utopia. The notion of Romanistan is always a source of inspiration for artistic and activist work by Roma. What, Nico, what is your Romanistan? It's a country, it's a virtual space. What is
it? For me, it's a virtual space. in Mao mm-hmm. modern society. Maybe if you would have asked me 20 years ago, I wouldn't say that. But for me, mm-hmm. it's a virtual space where it's plenty of resources to protect our people, as I said earlier, and to build this network of support, an ATSEF, safety net for all our people, wherever they are. A space where young people find that you can be, you can live the Roma identity with dignity wherever you are, and that there's no one who should tell you how to live it. That's, of course, for me, Romanistan is also should have some rules, as all nations. I repeat myself, it should also, Romani Band for me and Romanistan should become the moral compass in everything we do every day mm-hmm. of our life. So mm-hmm. it should be internalized as much as others internalize the values of their holy books, you know. Mm-hmm. This Bible or Quran, doesn't matter, but we have to build this, this moral compass for our people and for ourselves. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a virtual space where in case of danger and in case of need, people know that it's a space where you can ask for help. There's a space where you can express your fears, your identity in different ways. That there's a space where you find yourself.
And by virtual space, do you mean that, I don't know, the people of Romanistan get their passport, but they do not have a country or do not have land? Or do you rather mean like Romanistan is a notion, ethic guidelines, joint values that serve like what you called the moral compass?
Mm-hmm. It's no land for sure, because I don't like the idea of having a fight for a land. It's not for me something which our nation should do, but it's a virtual space. Really, it's a space which you occupy virtually. It's also a space, not physical, but how you call this? State of mind. It's a state of soul. It's a state of everything you want in order to you to feel protected and good wherever you are. So. And for me, the virtual space is the space where you find these resources in order for you to become active. And I always speak about the social apathy of our people and where you find yourself, you know, and also where you find resources, you know, because people, mm-hmm. all nations and all people are attracted by resources. So what this virtual space and Romanistan gives you as a member of it, so what are the resources we give to people? So for me, the resources related to the protection of our people, wherever they are, it's very important that you protect our people, we protect our people, and that's a virtual space. It's a space where they can relate on and ask for protection and for help.
Mm-hmm. Bill, what do you think about the idea of Romanistan? Did you ever think about it? How does your Romanistan look like?
I think, well, it sounds like I'm going to repeat everything that Nico just said, because I more or less agree with it. But yeah, if you would have asked me 20 years ago or 10 years ago, I would say, yeah, no, I don't want it. I don't need it. And from a point of view of it being like a physical space, no, there's no point. We've survived without it, and we will continue to survive without it. But as a state of mind, it's because it does exist as a state of mind, and it needs to be a state of mind for a lot more people. And it is a kind of virtual space. So I would see it as that. It is the source of energy, or it attracts people to, there is an attraction there to defend what exists and to create something new. That's what it should be, in my opinion. How do you create that? Well, everybody contributes to that. So it's a virtual space for creating an awareness that we all can do, whatever that may be.
Yeah, yeah. And it seemed to be an inspiring idea, because it's really obvious that this notion of Romanistan comes up again and again in exhibitions, in publications, in cultural projects. So it really is a laboratory somehow. Like people give a lot of energy in it. It's a space where you can figure out and dream of a better reality, of a better future.
Yeah, I think that the image of the laboratory fits very well for me, because there's experiments that we have to perform and we have to explore and find new things, because like we said before, we don't want to just recreate the same old stuff. And 10 years ago, or if you just throw out Romanistan and I think of land and I think of a country, and I think, no, I don't want to recreate the old junk anymore. Mm. There has to be something new. So a laboratory, a think tank, something that's going to be created and is in continual process of creation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Nico, is Romanistan your utopia and your dream for Europe?
For me, Europe is a construction, and it's like, you know, I mean, it's a political construction in which I live and I have to live in, and we have to bend with the rules that we are living in these societies. But in the same time, for me, Europe and the whole question of the European Union, and is now questioned by Brexit and the whole and the pandemic and everything, it demonstrated that it's Europe is, it should be also a state of spirit. It's not longer, the pandemic showed that, you know, because it's no longer questions of border, of nations and languages. We lived the same bad experiences during the COVID and this, you know, and we lived the same abuses from power. So for me, utopia for Europe will be almost the same as Romanistan, but for me, utopia for Europe would be what all the, you know, the people of European Union founders have thought about it. It's also the question of how you discuss about what is happening now about white supremacy everywhere. And for me, the whole constructions, political constructions around me are dangerous nowadays, because they leave the space for people to express these ghosts and of the past, because UK is thinking that it's still an empire, but it's not. France as well. So I think in the mental collective of the Europe now, especially the Western European countries, is that they think they are the nations which used to be, because they have historically acted in the collective mental of being an imperium, but they are no longer an imperium. I think that all the crisis around us is partially because of this, because all the former imperiums in Europe, they are no longer imperiums, and people and politicians and collective mental should change. And it's very difficult to understand that you are an island, a small island, and not an imperium any longer. It's really interesting how Europe is redefining itself today, but it's also a danger. I don't know, but since I live here in UK, I'm trying to understand how Western European position itself, and it's interesting to see this post-colony. I mean, I know this post-colonialism was in the 70s, but nevertheless in mental collective and in some of the sick minds of politicians, some of the politicians, it's not gone. Is this lack of humbleness, lack of touch of reality? So it's like France as well, Spain, and all these big powers, which used to be big powers. They are nations like all the others. So it's a reconfiguration of Europe today. And I think Roma has a very important role in it. And I mean, we could play an important role in it. And we could demonstrate to others that having this Romanistan across borders and non-borders is possible. And it's challenging for the others. I think we, Roma, have always been challenging the systems around us. And I think even today we are challenging Europe.
Yeah, because your Roma are a transnational community, and that is already challenging.
Yeah.
You mentioned about being underground, underground as in being maybe avant-garde. Can you express a little bit more about your Romatopia? How does that fit in? What's your vision there?
The underground one?
Yeah.
I mean, if I think about arts, right? All the arts movements which provoked change in arts and provoked the establishment of the arts were underground in the beginning. So for me, mm-hmm. Romatopoeia is an underground, which starts as an underground movement because it's no space for the mainstream. Mm-hmm. and you end up provoking the others and then you enter in mainstream. But I don't know how to enter in the mainstream because I wouldn't like to be part of all these... you know, maybe I'm wrong. I can be because I'm a part of a generation of people who does not really know how to use my power. I don't know how to use my power. I never knew, even though I had it all the time. So I think for me, the Romatopoeia is not, I wouldn't like to be in the United Nations. What is United Nations today? What is Council of Europe today? What is OEC today? You know, mm-hmm. like these intergovernmental organizations which really regulate the European Union. So I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I know that some of my younger colleagues would criticize me for that. That's a very left-wing oriented approach to this underground country. But it's like, you know, maybe you enter in mainstream later on and we see how we enter in the mainstream and which forms and how we can, for example, influence the politics in the countries where people, our nation sits. So that's my fault. My thoughts are not yet there because this should be, for example, I thought about the structure in the Romanistan, and I said about that. But in relation to other political structures and to the power, to the real power, with the real power structures which we have around us, then my thought is not yet so articulated. For me, underground means that you start to challenge current political sciences, the current politics, the classical notion of a state. So that's for me underground, like in arts, you know.
Yeah. That's why when you said that, I really wanted to hear you develop that, and I think I want to share. I share that vision. I think that, you know, being underground, being avant-garde, being something that attracts people to want to be this way or want to do things this way. Once you attract people and you're on the cutting edge, you're the first ones to do something. Eventually, people come around to it, and that's how the underground comes to the mainstream. Is mm-hmm. it's through this attraction and it's through these positive ideas and showing how, you know, a better vision for art, better vision for culture, better vision for politics, whatever you have. I like that idea of the underground. I haven't actually heard it said out loud, but I that's why I want.
I have the courage to say it.
It sounds good.
Absolutely.
That sounds really good.
Very interesting. Also, this idea of, it's deconstruction work, and you do this from the underground, not from within the system somewhere, but really you start deconstructing the basis of the wrong system, let's say. And it's also interesting that you say that maybe it needs the underground, that this power can really unfold.
I mean, I'm deconstructive and reconstructive. I mean, I have with my feminism, I have done that. Not only with my feminism, but with all my activism, I have. I don't know. I hope that I will have this time to write all these things sometimes.
Yeah, and I think we all want you to write this, and I think you have a big audience that's ready and waiting for whenever you're ready to have it.
Absolutely.
we want to read it.
Nico, let's finish this amazing and thought-provoking conversation with one last little game. Imagine if you could ask one question on all radio, TV, print media in Europe for one day. What question would this be?
Oh my God. That's really challenging, Isabel.
Yeah.
I would ask people if the hate they feel towards us make them feel better.
Yeah, very good question.
Yeah.
If the hate towards Roma make them feel better.
Yeah, brilliant answer. Nico, thank you so much for this conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
I hope we weren't too challenging.
No. I mean, but you know that I like challenges. You know me very well.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I know. Thanks for being with us for the last hours. It was so nice talking
thank
to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Romatopia is supported by the Federal Agency for Civic Education and the Council of Europe Roma and Travelers team. Idea and concept, Isabel Rabe. Romatopia is hosted and edited by Isabel Rabe and William Biela and directed by Katja Lehmann. Sound design by Selamet and Kefait Prizreni. Cover motif by Daniel Baker. Production, Media Bricks Berlin 2020.